Hello, my name is Dan Badger, and I have the privilege of welcoming you to this episode of Words of Endearment with Bill Coker. Bill's message, A Principle of Faith, is based on Romans chapter 3, verses 27 through 31. He preached this sermon in December of 1997 at World Gospel Church, and therefore Bill relates Paul's message to Christmas. While writing about faith, Paul upholds the law. The tension is about earning faith by our works. In Jesus, there is both a divine initiative and a historic reality. In this, we see faith and law united. Now, here's Bill.
And it's interesting when you tie in what he has written with the Christmas story and this season of the year. And you realize that all that he is writing in this letter to the church at Rome really grew out of this manger scene in Bethlehem. Who would have guessed at the time of Jesus' birth? Certainly those shepherds could not have realized the full dimensions of the significance of his coming. And even the Magi who came to worship could hardly have comprehended the breadth and length, the depth and the height of this tremendous message that was going to go out and shape the world over the next 2,000 years to our present time. We've been looking at chapter 3, and for just a couple of moments, I wanted to call your attention to the conclusion of that third chapter, because there's an interesting thing that Paul does in this that, because of modern translations into English, we may tend to slip by it and never see it. But beginning in verse 27 of chapter 3, he says, "Then what is of our boasting? It is excluded. On what principle? On the principle of works? No, but on the principle of faith. For we hold that a man is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also, since God is one. And he will justify the circumcised on the ground of their faith, and the uncircumcised through their faith. Do we then overthrow the law by this faith? By no means. On the contrary, we uphold the law." That last statement really comes into focus. If you go back to the original Greek and notice the phrases that Paul uses, as I say, we lose them in translations into English because the translators try to give us maybe a better insight into an idea. And sometimes they confuse the issue. But he ends up this third chapter by saying, on the contrary, we're not denying the law, we're upholding the law. And to catch the full thrust of that, you have to go back at the beginning of this paragraph when Paul says, what happens to our boasting? It's excluded. On what law? Not principle. On what law? And then he says, on the law of works? No, but on the law of faith. I was struck how interesting that little phrase was, because through these first three chapters, there seemed to have developed quite a tension between the idea of law and faith. Because all along, Paul has been saying that the Jewish law was not their means of redemption. But he was not talking about the law in the sense of God's revelation. What he was contradiction, and the tension is here, it was their idea of a law of works by which they could merit God's favor. And that's where the tension really lies. But he uses that phrase, the law of faith. And it really struck me this week as I was thinking about this letter to the Romans and where we have come and through which we have passed as we've reached the end of this third chapter. And I thought, how important for us to notice that it is the law of faith. It is the principle of faith. It is the basis of faith. It is the system of faith that really brings a person into the full understanding and appreciation of that which God has given us in the gift of His Son, Jesus Christ. Now, Martin Luther was going to make something very famous. He was going to say, we are saved not by works, but by faith.
faith alone. And that little Latin phrase, sola fide, by faith alone, really became a watch cry of the Protestant Reformation. To this very day, when we talk about Protestantism, we say that we proclaim sola fide by faith alone. And we put two phrases together, sola gratia, only by grace, and sola fide, only by faith. Now, you may be tempted to think that Martin Luther was the one who invented this phrase, but he really was not. You see, he was preceded by a very, very famous Roman Catholic theologian by the name of Thomas Aquinas, who in his Summa Theologica referred to the fact that we are saved sola fide, only by faith. We thought Martin Luther invented this. But no, not just simply Thomas Aquinas, but back through the church fathers, even to Origen, the father of what we call textual criticism, the study of the Greek texts. Back that far into the third century, Origen was saying, it is only by faith. Only by faith. How could they say anything else? Paul made it so very clear, didn't he? So whether we come out of a Protestant stock or a Catholic stock or an Orthodox stock, it really doesn't make any difference because the message of Paul has been through the centuries the foundation. Men have sometimes perverted it to talk about by our works we're going to gain the favor of God. But that never was Paul's idea, and that certainly was not the story of the church. But what does this really mean for us, looking at Paul's letter to the Romans or studying church theology and church history? What does it mean to say sola fide, only by faith? How do we apply that in terms of our own lives? And it seems to me that some things are very obvious and some things maybe not so obvious. Obviously, we're saying that there's nothing we can do to merit the favor of God. In fact, we've rehearsed this several times already just in looking at Paul's letter to the Romans. He says it so clearly, not by anything you've accomplished. But you know, the tragedy is that too many of us, in fact, maybe I should say it is the temptation for all of us to be like a very unsavory Christmas character. And you think I mean Scrooge, but I don't. I mean little Jack Horner. What an unsavory character this is. Little Jack Horner sat in a corner eating his Christmas pie. He stuck in his thumb and he pulled out a plum and he said, "What a good boy am I." And this unsavory Christmas character has been the model too often for many of us. Easy to look at ourselves and say, "What a good boy I am. Look what I have done. Look what I've accomplished." Paul really had to battle that. When he talks in Romans later about the battle between covetousness and holiness, maybe we're going to not see Paul, the real Paul, before he met Christ and his life was transformed. But you get an inkling of it when in Philippians he talks about people boasting and he said, you know, they may boast, but I have more reason to boast. I am an Israelite of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, and as to the law, a Pharisee, and I'm perfect in the matters of the law. I could boast. Now, the reason Paul could think of that is because there was a time when that was precisely what he did. And unfortunately, there's a time when many of us still do that. We are tempted to think, look what I've accomplished, look what I have done. And yet when we read this, Paul is saying to us so clearly, it is the law of faith, not the law of works, that brings us redemption. It is that principle of trust and obedience. Now, as I thought about that this week, I thought, you know, it's obvious that Paul is denying that we can merit it. He has said enough already in these three chapters that we hardly need to say it again, except that we need to be reminded ever so often that it is not by what we do, it's by what God has put forward for us in the gift of His Son. But as you think about this, it strikes me that there is something so very, very personal in all of this. That it is the law of faith, something that really can't be practiced by someone for someone else. And when it comes to the game of life, if you please, you and I are in a one-on-one with God. It doesn't make any difference what someone else has done or said, what they may be or not have been. It really boils down to you and God, to me and God. And what is my relationship with Him? And when we talk, is it by the works of the law? Paul says, not at all. It is on the principle or upon the law of faith. And at that moment, I'm introduced very, very firmly into that idea that there's only one way that law can operate, and that's on a personal basis. However much we might recite our faith as a body of believers, it ultimately comes down to a one-on-one with God. So you may be tempted to say, well, you know, I'm better than a whole lot of other people. And maybe you can sit and say, well, you know, I know a lot of people who profess to be Christians, and their lives are certainly as unsavory as little Jack Horner or Scrooge, or we can list a whole bunch of other people, can't we? But that really doesn't make any difference. What someone else is or is not has nothing to do with my one-on-one with God. It is not a measure of who they are or what they do. It is a measure of who I am and what is my relationship with God. And there's something so intensely personal about this law of faith that as we sit and worship together, though we do it corporately and as a body, rejoice in the power and the presence of God, we still, as an individual, come face to face with God. His claim upon our lives and our relationship with Him. So we look at this passage and we say, you know, this really helps me to understand more about the Bible too. Because the Bible is not an abstract book of theology where you get offered all of these theories and principles. It's primarily a story about people. Moses, Aaron, Jacob, David, Saul, and we could go through the Old Testament, come right on down into the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, Peter, and the list goes on. The Bible is about people. So you can't be surprised that in chapter 4, what is Paul going to do? He's going to say, let me tell you about Abraham. And he links up this whole concept of the law of faith with an individual, Abraham. And it is in that individual's life with God that Paul says, here is the illustration of what I'm trying to say to you. So it's intensely personal. And you and I at the Christmas season come to the point, and we should come to the point where we realize that we're in a relationship to God, a one-on-one. Whatever others may do or say, it comes down to ourselves. There's another thing that strikes me about this passage, and that's the fact that when I think about faith and the law of faith, I think that what Paul is talking about is a convinced acceptance. It's an acceptance of that which God offers us in Christ, but it's a convinced acceptance. And I had to put those two words together because I don't know how we can fully accept the story of Christmas without a deep conviction that this is the truth. I don't know about you, but I listen to the carols that are sung, and I attend very much to the idea of the lighting of the Advent candles, and I recognize that in all of these things, there are verbal and visual symbols that are a part of my faith. But behind every one of these things is the reality of a historical event. Is the fact of Jesus of Nazareth. And it has to be a convinced acceptance for every one of us. We can't really play act our way through this business of a relationship with God. We can't do as I used to do as a child when we would play a game and we'd say, let's pretend. And then we could pretend that we were someone else, or we could pretend that we're doing something else. You know that I'm a fan of Calvin and Hobbes. And I have to admit, last night, just before turning off the light, I read a few more pages of Calvin and Hobbes. I love this little character. His mind takes off, and the imagination that is so graphic, so, and you know, I think we identify with a lot of this Calvin business. And as I was thinking about Calvin and his active imagination, all of that may be good and it may be amusing in its place, but when it comes to my relationship with God, all of the imagination in the world can't really suffice. It's got to go deeper than just simply pretense. And so when I say it's a convinced acceptance, what I'm saying is that I'm satisfied that historically in Jesus of Nazareth, there is the divine initiative that God has taken to reach down to us. And not only a divine initiative, but a historical reality that really comes into focus with Christ's death on the cross. At which point, I'm given the opportunity to identify with Christ. A convinced acceptance. And a converting acceptance. In which it introduces such a tremendous change into our lives. Jesus is the focal point of Christmas. It'd be hard to argue against that, except in the most secular mind that's caught up in the commercialism of our day. But the point is that Jesus is not just simply the center of Christmas. He is the center of life. He is the whole. And for us who believe that He is the Son of God, there cannot be anything else. On what principle is boasting excluded? Is it on the law of works? No. But it is on the law of faith. An oxymoron? No. No, because there is no contradiction in this. It is faith working through the law that God revealed to Moses and through the faith that works by the law of God in your life and mine.
Thank you for listening. Please send any comments to Bill and Ann by email. We would love to hear your feedback. We encourage you to check out Bill's books on Amazon, which can be found in the episode notes. We hope this time has been a blessing for you, and that you will tune in next week for Words of Endearment with Bill Coker.